7 trillion.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky. I'm your host, Dee Andrew, and our guest tonight is Dennis Balthizer, a resident of Roswell, New Mexico, and a big researcher on the subject. And as everybody who knows me knows that Roswell's my thing, I love Roswell. And how are you this evening, Dennis?
I'm doing good. Glad to be on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate you being on our inaugural edition of the show. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Would you like to tell the audience a little more about yourself and what you want, like, your research into?
Well, my background is civil engineering. I had 3 years in the United States Army and was in an engineering battalion assigned to Greenland twice, which I never forgave the Army for. And then got out of the Army. I went to work for the Texas Highway Department, Texas DOT. Spent 33 years in civil engineering, quality assurance, and quality control work for the state of Texas, traveling around 37 states, Korea, South Africa, to inspect materials. And when I retired at the age of 54 in 1996, I sent out resumes basically all over the country because I had a lot of contacts from all the shops and plants I had worked with, intending to keep my engineering work going. Been interested in ufology probably 20, 25 years, started as a hobby, bought a book by Jacques Vallée years ago and lay out in the backyard down in El Paso where I used to live and look out in the night sky and just wondered what was out there. And then when I had the opportunity, an engineering company in Roswell hired me and I came up here and went to work for them and was doing really well considering everything. And started volunteering at the UFO Museum on weekends, and then started going in at lunchtime and after work and picking up correspondence and getting involved. And after about 6 months, I decided to do that full-time. So in 1996 until 1998, I was a 70-hour-a-week volunteer at the museum, the UFO investigator, and on the board of directors for a year. And then in 98, I decided to go independent, go on my own. I've been working with Stanton Friedman quite a bit and still do, nuclear physicist who was the original Roswell researcher. And basically the rest is history. I became involved with the Roswell incident very heavily through witnesses that I met, first-hand witnesses in most cases, many of the researchers, and then I branched out into three other areas, and I decided years ago to not try to get into everything related to UFOs and ufology because pretty quickly you can become an authority on nothing. You need to concentrate on certain parts of it, and that's what I decided to do with the 1947 Roswell incident, Area 51 up in Nevada, underground bases, primarily because of my engineering background. My curiosity with that, and then a few years ago I was invited to join the Great Pyramids of Giza Advisory Board, which has turned out to be just fascinating research.
Oh, I agree. I read so many different theories on the pyramid complex. One thing I wanted to get into, though, with you tonight is on the Walter Haut apathy.
Well, you go right for the jugular vein, don't you?
Oh, yes. This is ever since I read it, you know, I found an extract from it online. Actually, I should say my husband did.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since I read that and I saw that the date that was on there, I'm going, okay, because, as you know, Walter's memory was deteriorating really badly from what I understand.
Did you interview him, Dee?
I wasn't allowed to.
Why?
I was, well, when I went to the UFO museum the first time, it was, you know, just me. I went by myself and spent the whole week down there. In fact, a lady in one of the stores there actually gave me your name and phone number while I was down there, and unfortunately I didn't have enough time to call you.
Mm-hmm.
But I went in and I had seen this gentleman that was working there. I don't know his name or, you know, what his job title was, but he was telling me, asking me, you know, is there any way that I could, you know, talk to Walter or Glenn Dennis?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd given him my ICAR card. And he says, well, you can speak all you want to with Mr. Dennis, but unless Walter's daughter's here, no, you can't ask him anything.
When was this?
This was, I think about early June of
2003. That's interesting because supposedly Walter did an affidavit back in 1993, and I'm trying to get a copy of that. I didn't know much about that. I was at the museum 7 days a week from 96 until 98, talked to Walter every day. Not necessarily about UFOs, but he was an interesting gentleman. And in 2000, Wendy Connors, a historical ufologist, and I were filming with a French public television company, like our PBS here, and they were interviewing Walter. And Wendy and I both heard Walter mention seeing bodies to this crew. Well, Wendy and I went outside and we looked at each other and said, did you hear what I heard? Because he had never talked about that before in any of the interviews he had done or any of the conversations I had with him. So we decided we better get him on videotape because Walter was getting up in years, had a fascinating background in life, and we set up for a oral history, basically, to get information about Walter, which we would pass on to the family. We agreed that we would not sell the videotape based on demands of the daughter, now the director of the museum, and we would use it for our research. Well, during our interview in 2000, he couldn't remember where he took basic training. He couldn't remember dates. He couldn't remember a lot of names. And was very evasive, really, about answering anything to do with the Roswell incident. Now, there's two ways to look at that. One, that he was still being quiet and protecting himself, or the fact that he just absolutely didn't remember. But shortly thereafter, Wendy Connors and I got a written threat from the daughter saying that we could not use any of the information we had on that videotape. Wendy Connors and I copyrighted the tape, so the tape belongs to us. And on the tape, Walter understood that we would not sell it, but we would use it for research, the information. And I left it pretty much at that. And then this affidavit came out recently in a book by Don Schmidt and Tom Carey saying that there's another affidavit, a written affidavit, that was done in December of 2002. And in that affidavit, that written affidavit, Walter is extremely precise with dates, with names, with events, which just absolutely astonishes me after having done 3.5 hours of videotape with him 2 years prior. Problem I have is I don't know who wrote the new affidavit. I don't know if Walter himself wrote it or not. It's a notarized affidavit, which means nothing except that whoever notarized it watched him sign the paper and agreed that that was the person signing the document. So that has no bearing on it. What has bearing on it is who wrote it, when was it obtained, by whom. So I have a lot of questions about this latest affidavit based on my own knowledge of Walter and the fact that there is no information coming forward about how it was done or when it was done.
I was very surprised, too, when I saw that date, because when I did get to speak with Glenn Dennis, Walter was in the office. It was the three of us sitting there in the office, nobody else, had the door closed. And I could speak with Glenn for as long as I wanted. But Walter, he would just kind of sit there and joke around and, you know, just... He was just like a third party in listening, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just surprised at being told I couldn't even ask him one single little question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I respected their wishes. I didn't want to get in trouble and get kicked out of there myself.
Well, it seemed a lot to me that, you know, the video affidavit, to me, I would think, would have more substance than a written affidavit, particularly if no one's going to give us the information on how it was obtained or when and things like that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying Walter didn't do it, but I am saying I want to confirm how it was done and when it was done, because that's my job as a researcher. I can't just accept the fact that Walter Hall signed an affidavit in 2002 with all this information. I can't just accept that. That's not the way I do research.
Yes, I agree. Like you said, I would go more with the video documentation that you did. In fact, personally, I'd like to see that myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it surprises me that...
Well, and then you're saying in 2003, which would have been a few months, really, because he signed that affidavit, I think, in December 2002.
Yeah, it would have been about 6 months later.
And then within 6 months, apparently he went into his Alzheimer's or whatever the reason was for him not being allowed to do an interview.
Yeah, but, I was just amazed at that myself.
Yeah. Well, it's something that I'm going to continue to research along with some others and see if we can't get to the bottom of when it was done, how it was done, and who did it. And that's important.
Well, when you find that out, let me know, and we'll get you back on, and we can talk about that.
Sure, that'd be great.
I'd appreciate that.
Yeah.
Because this is a story I have been following since I was, again, 10 years old, reading
My wife and I saw Glenn, I guess, 2 weeks ago at the grocery store here in town, and I stopped him and talked to him a few minutes, and Glenn's getting up in years now. He's probably 80, 81. And I don't believe that the director of the museum allows him to do any interviews anymore. And I think that's been for some time that she's put a lid on that. So I don't know what her motive is, if this is for her own benefit or what, but it's definitely something that needs to be looked into.
I agree. And Glenn Dennis was such a very nice guy when I met with him. The one burning question I needed answers to was, what happened to the nurse?
Mm-hmm. Everybody now, asked that question. And
now, whether he told me the truth or not, I don't know. But he did tell me a story that kind of tugged at the heartstrings, so to speak.
She went into a continent?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's basically his story. I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but years ago, two researchers had pressured him for the name of the nurse, and he gave them a name, and then 5 years later, after they spent a lot of time and money looking for this person, he told them that he had given them the wrong name. So his credibility, to me, is questionable. I like Glenn. He's just a delightful person to be around. Got some fantastic stories about his life as a mortician, but there's a whole lot of factual information that can't be confirmed in Glenn Dennis's stories, of which the nurse is probably the primary one, But the 6-foot-2 redheaded captain that said you'll find your bones out in the sand has never been found. The black sergeant has never been found. He said that the nurse was shipped out to Europe and killed in a plane crash. There's no record of a plane crash. There's just nothing that can be verified with Glenn's story, although I do think he was probably involved at some point, having been the mortician at Ballard Funeral Home, and did take the GI out to the base, as he said, but been in an accident and probably saw some material out there. But none of the people that he talks about could be found, and that creates major problems. The drawing that the nurse did, supposedly he had in a safe at the mortuary at Ballard Funeral Home, and I believe Stanton Friedman and him went to get it out of there, and when they got there, it wasn't there, and he didn't remember if he lost it or if somebody had taken it or what. So, you know, there's a lot of key remarks that he's made over the years that really I'm questioning quite a bit.
Well, and then I had discussed with him the interview he did for Omni magazine about the nurse.
Yeah.
And how the interviewer had pressured him into giving a name. And he said, oh, I just made up one.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, that was kind of obvious. The name, you know, Naomi Self.
Yep.
You know, that kind of just rung as a fake name to me. Right.
Well, the Air Force in their 1994 voluminous report had a picture of a nurse who they said probably was the nurse, and of course that wasn't, but that was the Air Force's way of getting around it. But that's what's hard about this research, Dee, is, you know, you just can't take people's word. You have to be able to confirm and verify information before you really go public with it. And I have a lot of questions about a lot of these people.
Well, and then in the museum, there's a picture of a lady, and there's a little sign under there that says, could this be the famous nurse?
That's from the Air Force report.
All right, well, I asked him about that, and he says, oh, no, I know who that is. And then he said a name, and, you know, I'm horrible with names.
Yeah.
But he said, no, that woman was the head of nursing at the Air Base Hospital.
Right. Yeah,
I'm thinking, well, why do they have it up there in the museum with that little sign under there saying that? Isn't that kind of a representation?
That's from the Air Force report. That's the one I just mentioned. That's where they got that. It came out of the Air Force report, and that's what they said, I think, in the report. Could this be the nurse?
Hmm. Oh, wow. Is there anything new that you've heard about Roswell other than the Walter Hutt affidavit?
Yeah, in fact, there were three books came out during the 60th anniversary here 2 weeks ago when we had the 60th anniversary and the festival. And by the way, the festival was a huge success this year. The city of Roswell took it over because it was the 60th anniversary, and because for the last 2 years under the leadership of the museum, the attendance was way down. And this recent one was comparable with the 50th anniversary, where we had 40,000 people here. Numbers are not in yet, but the best estimate is that we had 35 to 40,000 people this year.
Oh my, that's a lot.
Yeah, it doubles the size of Roswell. And there are three books came out in conjunction with the event, and hopefully that this will have some impact on the fact that we continue to be lied to about the Roswell incident by the government and the military. I guess that's probably wishful thinking on my part, but I remain optimistic that the pressure is on them, and I'm hoping they'll come clean here, you know, one of these years before I die. But one of the books is Jesse Marcel Jr.
I bought a copy of that, and I have to admit, it's a very good book.
It is excellent, and Jesse is as honest as the day is long. To me, he remains one of the most credible first-hand witnesses still alive that I've ever known. I've known him since 1997. He has a 30-year military career. In fact, he just got back not too long ago from Afghanistan. He was called up to active duty at the age of 68. He's a medical doctor. He's a helicopter pilot, and his MOS, his military work, is widely needed, and was called up to active duty and spent a year in Iraq and Afghanistan. And after all these years, he decided finally to write a book, and that was to fulfill a request by his dad, Major Jesse Marcel, who was the intelligence officer here. And in there, he as you know, he shares his own thoughts, plus his wife has a chapter in there about it, and the Marcel family has dealt with this for the last 60 years, and he has some information in there I thought very interesting, particularly the one meeting he had in Washington where he was taken down into the basement, and the government official asked him what he knew, and he said, well, you tell me what you know, and the guy told him that Roswell happened, and I thought that was of extreme interest. And I think it's a book for anybody that's serious about the Roswell incident. I think it should be required reading for anyone. In fact, I'm in process of writing an editorial, which will be on my website around the first of the month, about this new information that's come forward. The other one, of course, was Don Schmidt and Tom Carey's book, Witness to Roswell, where the last chapter or near the end of the book, they talk about the affidavit by Walter Holt. But the third book that came out was written by Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Martin. Kathleen Martin is the niece of Betty Hill, of Barney and Betty Hill fame of the abduction. And Kathleen personally knew her aunt and uncle well. And the book has captured the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience. And in there she shares a lot of new information that hadn't been released before. But in the back, I think it's on page 289, there is a drawing that Betty made while on the craft, while she was abducted. She said she saw a book that had writing in it that basically was symbols, not writing as we know writing, but symbols. And then a week after the festival, I got a call from John DeSalvo. Dr. DeSalvo was head of the Pyramid Association. He had read the book. And he thought there was a similarity between what Betty has in the book on those symbols and what Major Marcel drew in 1981 when that was his last interview before he passed away with Linda Corley. So what I'm proposing is that someone look at these symbols that were done by Major Jesse Marcel, retired, like Colonel, and those done in the Betty and Barney Hill abduction, because I think there's some similarities there. And if there is, then we need to pursue this, because I had originally sent Major Marcel's drawings to some of the members of the Pyramid Association, because people have referred to the writing on the I-beams here in Roswell as looking like hieroglyphics. And I thought there's no better place to find out once and for all, so I sent some of the drawings to some of our board members on the advisory board, and they all wrote back and said they didn't see any resemblance between Marcel's drawing and Egyptian hieroglyphics. So I think we have something new here to look at least, and to study. You may remember that Colonel Weaver in the Air Force report in 1994 stated that the pictures that were taken in General Ramey's office had been analyzed by a national laboratory. And that was probably the CIA or NSA, and nothing was gained from that analysis. However, some researchers with a lot less technical equipment than the CIA has were able to read some of the words on that memo that General Ramey is holding in that picture.
Mm-hmm. The picture's taken by James Bond Johnson,
who I interviewed, and it's on my website. In my last editorial, I talked about him, because he embellished his story towards the end. When I first talked to him and met him, he didn't have much knowledge about the Roswell incident. He did, in fact, take the pictures in General Ramey's office. They're kept at the University of Texas Arlington Library.
And now, the original negatives were there.
The negatives are there, and in fact, I just ordered four copies of the pictures so that I can use them in my lectures and on my website. So that's new information that I'm looking at, and hopefully, you know, down the road somewhere, we might be able to tie some of these symbols together and see if there's a correlation between the two, which would be interesting, because the Betty and Barney Hill incident and Jesse Marcel had no connection at all. Possibly do now, we don't know.
If I remember correctly, too, the same group that got the wording off of the piece of paper in Ramey's hand.
Mm-hmm.
Also took the full frame, not just the cutoff frame that everybody sees, but the full frame.
Right.
That shows a lot of the debris that's on the floor in front of Jesse Marcel.
David Rudiak did some of the best research on that. And
that,
in that article I wrote last month, if you look at the pictures again, look at the brown paper that's laying on the floor underneath the debris. That paper came off of a new roll of brown wrapping paper. There are no creases in it. It's not crumbled. And if that debris was packaged up for Major Marcel to deliver from Roswell to Fort Worth to General Ramey, that paper would not be flat and new-looking. And this is something that I just came across within the last few months, looking at the pictures again, and I've decided that there is no way that the paper, the brown paper, laying underneath the debris on the floor, it is off of a brand new roll of paper.
And then they were looking at some of the debris in that photograph and making it, you know, enlarging it. And they were wondering if some of the debris that looks like just sticks laying there could be the I-beam type material that Marcel Jr. speaks about.
First of all, the material laying on the floor is paper-backed, and the sonar buoys and the radar targets were not, on the mobile balloon, were not paper-backed. So there's a discrepancy. There has nothing ever been reported from the crash site or in the Ramey photos of any of that equipment. In fact, the mogul balloon that is most likely to have been the one to have crashed at the ranch was canceled because of cloud cover. And when they filled the balloons up at White Sands or at Alamogordo or at Holloman Air Force Base to launch them, if they canceled the flight, they released the balloons because the helium was already in them, so they couldn't take it out. But they would take all the equipment off of the balloon because it was reusable. None of that equipment has ever shown up in any accounts from the crash site or on the pictures. They have a weather balloon laying on the floor. And they called in Newton to take another picture, which Bob Johnson didn't take, where he confirmed that it was a weather balloon. And the debris field itself was 3/4 of a mile by several hundred yards wide. And whether it was a mogul balloon, a weather balloon tied to a mogul balloon assembly or whatever, it didn't cover enough area. The rancher had recovered balloons prior to 1947 because there was a reward. They had a tag on them, where to turn them in. And for a poor ranch foreman, that was a couple bucks that he wouldn't have had otherwise.
True.
So he knew what balloons were. And what he had on his ranch was not something he ever saw. Another point is what you sent out, the top intelligence officer in the world, Jesse Marcel, along with Captain Cavett, the CIC officer, would you send them 60 miles out of town to look at a balloon?
No.
Would you bring them back to the base with some of that balloon and then send them to Fort Worth,
Texas? They wouldn't have bothered.
No way.
Another interesting little tidbit I came up with and found out about Mac Brazel, William Brazel, is for years I had tried to figure out what the Army could possibly do to get him to keep his mouth shut. And I was reading through a book called UFO Encyclopedia, and for the life of me right at the moment, I can't remember who wrote it, but in there, the very first entry for Mac Brazel tells how back in 1909, he and his family had been investigated by Pat Garrett for cattle rustling, and that I believe it was his father killed Pat Garrett, and he was apparently in the group. There was a group of them that went after Pat Garrett.
Let me write this down. Brazel's dad killed Pat Garrett?
Yes. Or, excuse me, his uncle.
Okay.
And apparently he was in this group of men that went after Pat Garrett. Now, the theory is the Army held a murder charge over his head, because everybody knows there is no statute of limitations on murder. And said, okay, either you keep your mouth shut or you're going to hang for murder.
You know his uncle's name?
I can get it.
Why don't you email me?
I can do that.
I have access to the Historical Museum of Southeast New Mexico, and they have a lot of information on Garrett and Billy the Kid, stuff like that, and I can probably run a check on this. If we have a year, I can even check to see if maybe they were in the city directory.
1909.
1909?
Yes.
Okay. Well, another thing with Brazel was the fact that he was taken to the base and interrogated for several days, and what you're saying would tie in with that. If while he was there, they were threatening him about that previous incident, it would put the fear of God in you. Because when he came out of that interrogation, he stopped at the radio station and told them that he was wrong about the date. It happened on June 14th, not July 3rd. And also, you know, that it was a balloon. It wasn't a flying saucer. He totally changed his story and then never talked about it again.
Okay, we have the, I have that his uncle's name. It was Jesse Wayne Brazel.
Jesse Wayne Brazel. I looked that up. Interesting.
Kind of surprised, and I also mentioned that to Stanton Friedman and about that, and had the book in my hand and showed it to him, and you know, he was said he was going to check that out. We've got a hand up in our virtual auditorium. This is a two-way deal here. They can raise their hands and on their microphones and their computers.
Okay.
Can ask questions.
Great.
While they're asking questions, they can't hear you talking back.
Okay.
So as soon as they're done asking their question, you can answer that if you'd like to.
I would have it.
And I see Atreides has got his hand up. Atreides, do you have the mic?
Thank you, Dee. Hello, Mr. Balthazar. I've got three questions here. By the way, you're talking to Atreides in London. I've got three questions for you here. My first question is a very hypothetical question, Mr. Balthazar. It is designed to test who we trust. Now, I would like you to imagine with me that one day you're in your kitchen, one afternoon, and suddenly an extraterrestrial makes itself known to you. Now, for some reason, this extraterrestrial depends on you. Now, my first question is, who are the three first telephone calls that you would make to? You know, who are the first three institutes that you would call, and why? I hope you understand that question. An extraterrestrial's landed in your kitchen. It needs your help. I want to know who are the first three people you would call, and why? My second question is, in your whole career as being a researcher, I would like to know, where do you think you came the closest to, shall we say, touching an extraterrestrial? Do you know the expression, the one that got away? I would like to know, in the whole of your research and career, where have you come the closest to touching an extraterrestrial? And my third question is, what is your take on revelations, and can we put an extraterrestrial stroke ET equation into this? Thank you.
He got his money's worth. Are you there, Dee?
Yeah, I'm here. That's the treaties. He's known for that.
First question. He said, who do I trust? I certainly don't trust the United States government.
Don't bring me there.
I think they've proven that over the years. Young people are accepting cover-up, and I'm demanding that young people start asking questions and demand answers out of our government pertaining to UFOs, the Kennedy assassination, Watergate, Iran-Contra, the list goes on and on. As far as who I would call, I think the first person would be Stanton Friedman. I have full confidence in Stanton Friedman's research, his background, work closely with him, and I would go to him for advice. I've done this before, and I'll get into that in a minute. It's my interception. Off the top of my head, I don't know right now who I would call. You can't call the military. You can't call the government.
You could call me.
I could get the word out somehow to some researchers, or probably go public real quick with it on the media. The media not being national media, but being shows like yours or some of the other shows that I do have confidence in. On his second question about contact with an alien, I've not had that. In fact, I've never seen a UFO. My wife has, but I'm not I don't have a problem with that because I've never been to Australia, but I understand it's there. So I don't have a problem with the fact that I've never seen one. I have had a situation in 1997 where I went to Oklahoma to get a piece of metal from a gentleman who supposedly was a military policeman here. That story is on my website called The Interception. When I got to Oklahoma, I couldn't make contact. I was finally contacted, told to meet two people at a Denny's restaurant at 7 o'clock. I went there. A man and woman came in. He said, "Are you Dennis?" I said, "Yes." He said, "The gentleman you plan on meeting will not be here." I said, "Who are you?" He said, "We're special agents of the United States Air Force Office of Special Investigation." I said, "How'd you know I was coming over here?" He said, "We knew Monday you'd be there here Friday." I said, "Has my phone tapped?" He smiled and said, "You know how we do business." Changed my life. I spent 3.5 hours with him. Never got to meet the son or the father who had the medal. They told me that the family had decided the government should have it instead of me. I came back empty-handed, kept the story to myself for 4 months, made it into a lecture form, went public, and copyrighted it with the Library of Congress to protect myself. To this day, I don't know who I was dealing with or what their motive was. If they were real agents, we have a cover-up very much in place. If it was a hoax or a scam and I was set up, and that's a possibility, then I want to know who they were, because they're impersonating federal agents, and that's a pretty serious offense. On his final question about revelations, you may be surprised to know I'm a Christian. I have absolutely no problem being a Christian and doing UFO research. If you believe that God created everything, to me, everything means everything. And it doesn't say in the Bible that we're all that he made. In fact, if we are all that he made, I think he messed up. We're the only species on the planet that can't get along with each other. So I have absolutely no problem with it. If my faith is wrong, when I die, I haven't lost anything. If my faith is true, then I have everything to gain. So I have no problem with revelations, the interpretations in the Bible. The book of Ezekiel refers to flying fiery wheels. There's several things in the Bible, several scriptures that can be interpreted however you want to interpret them, and some of them seem to lean towards UFOs. Great questions.
Oh, that's this group. I tell you, a lot of people in this group. I have to give, you know, a little applause. These guys, they do their research. They're well versed. Mm-hmm. And when you said Stanton Friedman was the first person you'd call, you should have seen all the people in the virtual auditorium go, "Yeah, Stan." You know, he's the regular.
I've worked with a lot of researchers over the last 11 years doing this professionally, and Stanton and Frank Warren are probably two of the only two that I work closely with, because their record stands on its own. Stanton is a nuclear physicist. He's worked on top secret projects. He's a personal friend of mine, and we have discussed many, many things in relation to Roswell and UFOs in general, and I just have the highest respect for Stanton and always will. He's a no-nonsense guy, and him and I both are brutally honest, and a lot of people don't like that, but that's the way we come across, and that's the way I will continue to do my research. On my website and at lectures, I have a quotation, "Always telling the truth means never having to remember anything," and I try to live by that.
I saw him on Larry King Live here recently, and the gentleman, and I use the term loosely, the skeptic.
Shermer.
Yeah. Is it just me, or does that guy not know how to keep his mouth shut when somebody's answering a question that was directed to them?
I wrote to Stanton after the show, and I was very disappointed again in the show. Larry King was totally out of control as a moderator of that panel. I told Stanton, I said, "I'm so proud of you for not reaching over and just slapping the crap out of Shermer."
I think that's probably what I'd have done.
I mean, the man took it over, and then Aldrin, the astronaut, he finally fell off the fence. So I hope he just stays where he's at. You know, he's been back and forth on what they saw when they went to the moon, and now he came on the other night, like gangbusters and, you know, there's nothing to it. So we can't have that.
Yeah, I agree. Buzz Aldrin used to be one of my heroes, one of my childhood heroes.
Stan Friedman, Don Schmidt, Jesse Marcel Jr., and I did a special on the National Geographic Channel that aired a couple of months ago, last summer. They filmed me for 6 hours. They used my vehicle to run all over New Mexico at my expense, and we had no input. Researchers have no input into these documentaries that are put on by the major networks. And when that thing aired, they debunked us, and at the end of the show, the announcer said Roswell was nothing but a myth. And Stanton and I both wrote articles telling National Geographic how disappointed we were that as the National Geographic Network, they would stoop to what they just did. And I'm getting to the point with documentary makers that I'm not even going to do them because we have no input at all into the final product, the editing of it. You have people who know nothing on the subject that are doing the editing or doing the filming, and it's based primarily on ratings and profit. It has nothing to do with factual information.
We have a question in our virtual auditorium from someone without a mic. Celestial Maiden asks, how did you learn of the piece of metal when you went to retrieve it? Did the government take possession of it?
I was with the museum at the time, got a call from the son of this gentleman saying that they were going to, let me back up. His son didn't know that his dad had been stationed in Roswell in 47 as a military policeman, and the dad was dying of cancer. He had 6 months to live. He called his son into the retirement home and said, take that piece of metal out of my footlocker and put it on the nightstand, and they crumbled it up, and in a few seconds it went back to its original shape. It was about the size of a silver dollar. Claims that he had picked it up at the crash site, kept it all these years, and was now afraid. He said people will kill over that piece of metal. So they wanted to turn it into the Roswell Army Airfield, not knowing that the base closed down in the 60s. So somehow, I guess through an operator, a phone operator or somebody, they put in contact with me at the museum. And I had several conversations with the son, one with the father, and I did those from my residence because I thought probably that the phone was tapped at the museum, not knowing that my personal phone was tapped, and made arrangements to go over to meet the father and the son to get the medal, put him on tape, interview him, and then have it tested. Well, it never got any further than that because when I got there, I was met by these alleged agents who I spent 3.5 hours with. But it was a life-changing experience for me. I lost 18 pounds in 3 months. For about 5 days, I was paranoid. I turned ignition on my vehicle and didn't know what would happen. Should I get that opportunity again, I will do things differently. I will have somebody with me for protection, or I may even have some means of defending myself. I would do things a lot differently. I was completely naive, and I trusted these people based on the telephone conversations I had.
Trades has a follow-up question on this subject. He wants to know if you've ever been afraid for your life during this time, or have you ever thought that Men in Black are close to you or going to harm you in any way?
That's a catch-22. For 5 days, I was very concerned when I got back from Oklahoma, and then the stress of keeping it to myself for several months before I went public. When I finally went public, it was like a weight was lifted off of me. The information is out there. If something happens to me, everybody knows why. And that helped me a lot. But having done this like I do for 11 years now, I can truthfully say that I'm not worried because I can say anything I want to say on this show or in any editorial I write or lecture I do because the government can deny it. I have nothing I can prove other than witnesses and things like that. But when you start getting close to physical evidence or get a witness that is key witness, that's when you start feeling pressure. So I don't concern myself with it anymore. For years, I would go into a restaurant and I'd sit facing the door. I mean, subconsciously, you do these things. But, you know, as far as actually being afraid or being threatened, other than the Oklahoma experience, the interception, no.
Okay, we have another question here from our virtual auditorium. Please, do you have your hand up? You have the mic on.
Yes, appreciating this wonderful program. Tree Sheridan from Massachusetts. Mr. Balthazar, reviewing your informative editorials, I found one from 2005 describing the late Senator Barry Goldwater's efforts to ascertain the truth on UFOs, including his seeking access to the Wright-Patterson Blue Room facility. Mr. Balthazar, after almost a decade since the 1998 passing of Senator Goldwater, a great American patriot, do you feel, sir, that an official disclosure process will occur in this generation? Thanks for the response.
I did write an article about Goldwater. It's on my website. All my editorials are archived in the editorial section on my website, truthseeker@walshwell.com. Goldwater's story was kind of amazing because he was a candidate for President of the United States and lost to Johnson. He was a brigadier general in the United States Air Force Reserves and went to General LeMay and told him that he would like to go to the Blue Room at Hangar 18 at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, because he heard that's where they were keeping the stuff. He said General LeMay never had raised his voice to him all the time he knew him except that day and told him, don't ever ask me that question again. I don't have access to it, and you're sure as hell not going to get access to it. Goldwater believed until the day he died that UFOs were real. I think the man was a little ahead of his time as far as his thinking, but that was a good example of a high official running for president, being a brigadier general in the Air Force, not being allowed access to the information. Now, as a side point, most people don't understand or believe the President of the United States knows very little about this, if anything. Every president since Truman has tried to open up the UFO files with no success. I think the reason for that is that our presidents in the United States are temporary employees. They're here for 8 years maximum, and they can't be trusted. This information over the years has been classified higher, more secretive than the atomic bomb and the hydrogen bomb. And you don't have access to this information without need to know. And the president doesn't have need to know. He has people under him that work for him that know a lot more than he does because he doesn't have the security clearance. And that surprises a lot of people, but it's been proven time and time again. Jimmy Carter had a sighting that he reported to the Mutual UFO Network when he was a governor. He was going to open it up. Gerald Ford was going to open it up. Ronald Reagan came as close probably as anybody because he had a sighting or two and went to the United Nations and on videotape said that maybe we need something from outer space to bring us together on Earth and was told don't ever go public with information like that again. He had a private meeting with Gorbachev from Russia where they talked about UFOs. Bill Clinton, when he became president, his first term asked one of his aides, Hubble, to find information on the Kennedy assassination and the Roswell incident. Hubble reported back to the President of the United States that he could not find anything. If any president knew anything about UFOs, it possibly could have been George Bush Sr., because he was head of the CIA before he became president, and he might have had some access to some of the information.
Hey, we have another hand up in the room. Gossamer 777, you have the mic.
Yes, good evening, Mr. Balthazar. My name is David Andrew. I'm Dee's husband. Got to meet you in Roswell, and it was a pleasure to hear you speak. I was just curious, the rumors of Roswell say that the majority of the wreckage that was found ended up in Wright Pat. I was just curious, during your research, do you think that's true, or did it eventually get moved somewhere else? I'm sure some of it was, you know, back engineered and torn apart, little pieces going here and there. And also, I have another question. I was wondering, you know, lately it seems like there's been a lot of books and things coming out about people's different theories on what Roswell really was, you know. And I'm just curious, you know, you've got 400 or 500 people all basically telling similar versions of the same story about the same event. Why is it that people won't just accept that? Why do you think that they have to change and rearrange it? You know, is it just to make a name for themselves? Thank you.
I am very convinced that the majority of the material from the Roswell incident, and some, probably not all, of the bodies were taken to Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, which today is Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And the reason for saying it is because we have testimony from Pappy Henderson, who was a pilot who actually flew it, and we know that General Ramey had said that he was going to have the stuff forwarded to Dayton, Ohio, after he looked at it. There are reports that some of it may have gone to Washington. It could be so that Truman, President Truman, could see it. The reason it would have gone to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base are twofold. One, that's where the research and development was being done after the Second World War. Anything captured from the Germans was being back-engineered at Wright-Patterson. That would be the logical place to take debris. The second reason for taking it there was they had cold storage facilities for the bodies, which would have been the ideal place to take it. We do believe that perhaps some of the debris and perhaps one body may have gone to Los Alamos here in New Mexico to the National Lab. There's been talk that maybe something went down to White Sands. That's not been confirmed. As far as the number of books that are out and things like that, there are 2,000 websites on the Roswell incident. I'm fortunate to have one of the top 10, I'm told. And I spent way too much time putting out fires for people who are second, third, and fourth-hand researchers. Many of these people, probably 90% of the people that have these 2,000 websites, have never been to Roswell, never interviewed a witness, don't know where the crash sites are, and are relying on other people's information to do their research. And I'm firm on this because I spent a lot of time correcting things that I see on the internet or that I read in books. I went through Jesse Marcel's book, his new book, and I have highlighted a few things in there that are in error. Not purposely, probably, in Jesse's case, but they are in error, and they need to be corrected in the next publishing.
In addition to the state for hacking NASA, and what do you think about this guy? And we've only got about 4 minutes left.
Okay, first of all, let's explain what NASA stands for. NASA means never a straight answer. Now, the guy hacked into NASA's files, he should be prosecuted. However, NASA should take steps to protect that information, too. I believe we have two space programs. I think we have NASA for the public, and I think we have another program that we don't know about.
Oh, excuse me. Okay, I got some noise going in the background here. Unfortunately, this is all the time we have left. If you'd like to give your website and any books you'd like to recommend or your own you'd like to recommend, please.
Well, let's go to my website, www.truthseekeratroswell, all one word. That's the word at AT, truthseekeratroswell.com, my website, and then my email address is there. I try to answer all emails. I get 150 to 200 a day and probably delete 80%, but people that are interested in the subject and write to me, I do try to answer them. Go to the website, look at the editorials that I've been writing since 1999. There's a lot of information there. I have DVDs that I sell, I have a booklet, and do sell copies of the 1947 July 8th and July 9th Roswell Daily Record newspaper, which announced we have a flying saucer in our possession, and the next day General Ramey said no, it was a weather balloon. So check out the website, and great questions by your audience, and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. This audience has been coming together for quite some time now.
Let's do it again, Dee.
Oh, certainly. I'd love to have you back.
We haven't even touched on the pyramids, underground bases, and Area 51. Those are all interesting subjects.
I've been past Area 51 myself quite a few times and thought it was a little alien and fed my hidey hose. And
I did two lectures up there last May. In fact, I have a picture on my homepage on my website of me standing by the gate where I went out and harassed the guards.
Oh, great. A person I'd love to get on here is Chuck Clark.
He no longer lives up there.
Oh, he doesn't?
No, he moved, and he's still active with doing the research, but he has moved away from Rachel. I think he moved this summer.
Oh, my.
He's a neat guy. I've known him for several years and really like Chuck.
I met him there at the Little Alien,
yeah.
And he's a great guy to talk to, and like I said, love to get him on.
Government hates him.
Oh, I can understand why. I can understand why, especially after digging up one of those sensors.
He messed with government property there, and they went after him, so he demanded that some answers on why the thing was 15 miles outside of the boundary, and they said, here's your stuff, and they gave it back to him.
Yeah, well, unfortunately for this, that's all the time we have tonight. I thank you again very much for being on, and we'll be sure to get you back.
Thank you, and keep up the good work.
Well, thank you for being my first guest on my first show. I appreciate it very much.
Good.
Okay, thank you. And that's all the time we have. And remember, everybody, back at the same time next week. And so then, on Paranormal Radio Network. And until then, keep your eye to the sky. Thank you.
I see there's a world.